The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to the Best Morning Routine Ever podcast, the show that proves no one stumbles upon success ever. With your host, Lou Need. Every Mondays and Thursdays, we deliver cold hard evidence behind the power of a robust morning routine. Get ready to be transformed by the renewal of your mind.
Hello, morning enthusiasts. Welcome to the Best Morning Routine Ever podcast. I am your host, Lunit Lewis, and today I have the honor of introducing one spectacular man to the show who is going to dive into the science behind routines, which is right up the alley of what we do here at the podcast. So his name is Dr. Angel Iskovich, but we will call him Dr. I. To his patients, that's what he's known as, his friends and followers. He is an experienced CEO, doctor, telehealth expert, and thought leader armed with keen insight into human behavior. Whether you caught COVID or not, there has been collateral damage experienced by all and collateral value, as he calls it. Dr. I has the secret formula to show us how to source that wealth of collateral value, finding meaning and purpose in the past year, how we can actually hone in to see the good and see what comes out of that year. So we're looking forward to talk to Dr. I, not only about the past year and the value that it bought, but also his book. He has a book called The Art of Routine, How Routinology Can Transform Your Life. So I'm looking forward. That's decades of work of his stuff. So with no further ado, Dr. I, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Appreciate being on your show.
It is a pleasure. Such an honor. So tell us about your journey. How you gotten here so far?
Well, thank you. Well, we immigrated from Argentina. I was born in Buenos Aires, Argentina, to parents who were both caught in the war and both ended up being in concentration camps. And somehow they met in Argentina and my brother and I came about. And life was difficult for them in the late 50s and the sort. And we immigrated to the United States with about $100 and two valises, a red and a blue one, I remember, and a friend who sponsored us to become citizens here in the United States. So we immigrated and then kind of the journey kind of began there. And really what I've known is really being here in the United States and kind of went from my interest in philosophy to then going to school and becoming a physician and then having interest in both psychiatry, behavior, and then eventually being an emergency physician actually for a lot of years, 25 years, and also helping develop emergency medicine early on as it started in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, and it was a new field. And through that experience, I kind of learned a little bit about the world of how to manage emergency physicians because we developed contracting. It was required for hospitals to have emergency physicians and kind of got a little bit into the corporate world and learned quite a bit about that and the ambulance services like American Medical Response and large emergency systems. And so I did a lot of that kind of work. And over the last year or two, I've kind of been transitioning after many, many years and doing philanthropic work with groups like Direct Relief, which I was fortunate enough to help and be part of the board. And kind of got to thinking a little bit about not just my life, but reflecting a little bit on human nature and putting my interests in behavior and philosophy together. And kind of started to think about today's world and how important maybe routine, regularity, and rhythm is, and how important the environments we're in, and how we're kind of in a very disruptive world. Many things are a lot of pieces of news bite information that comes to us every day, in many cases disrupting us, especially like what happened with COVID, from our routines. And the things that really are everyday lives and our abilities to, you know, move on with that, affecting us in many different ways regarding stress, both personal, social, and our abilities to really live good and happy and content lives. So I got interested in that early on when I studied people that were had longevity, people that were centenarians, people over 100 years of age.
Wow.
And when I studied them, I noticed two things were really in common. And that was, one, that they had a very stable environment, both physically and the people around them. And two, that they did things regularly. They did things in a routine. But what they did varied. Mm-hmm. The content of what they did varied. And so that was a little bit of part of what I learned. And I thought, well, some people did things that weren't all necessarily considered healthy, but they had that scotch every day at 5 o'clock before the meal, or they walked in the store. And I started thinking, maybe we're paying too much attention to what it is we do, and that maybe we need to pay a little more attention to how we do it, the regularity, the rhythm, and where we do it, where we live, how important our environments are. I started thinking about high performers, and I started thinking about how we care for our young and about good companies and businesses. And I asked the question, why is that the case? And started to see that really, if you start to think a little bit about our science, the science of chronobiology, our circadian rhythms, mm-hmm. how our bodies work throughout the whole day, the rhythmic aspects of how our life is and how we perceive our life, the sun comes up and goes down, the seasons and the sort, that there was kind of a connection here. And that basically led to my trying to make a little bit of an insight in nature in the book called The Art of Routine, which is coming out this next week.
It has evolved. Your career has evolved. So from philosophy to medicine, to ER, to CEO, to actually working with human behavior in like on a corporate level, to now going back to looking at the science of circadian clocks, internal body clocks. So that's very intriguing. And I want to get into that because one thing I do with my clients and tell people that we talk to is your body has its own internal clock. It has a best time to go to bed, a best time to wake up. And if once we hone into that, that's when we can become higher performers. And we can work with our bodies instead of against our bodies. But first, I have to ask you, as an immigrant, though, I'm an immigrant myself. I'm from Haiti. And we hear from our parents coming in from a third world country that, you know, you go to school, you become a doctor, you become a lawyer, you become an engineer, and that's how you make it. And you and I fulfill that. But when did that interest spike to do philosophy? Because you came in at a young age, too.
Right. You know, it's hard to know, but you're absolutely right. You know, you're coming from places where your parents are want you to be educated. Yeah. They want you to do well. They want to have a better life than they had. And I surely know a lot about Haiti with our direct relief and what happened in, you know, recent years. We did a lot of work at Haiti. So I think sometimes I was involved in sports. So that had certain leadership pieces. I was involved in sports where I was kind of a captain of a team. I think naturally I had some leadership interests. And I took a course before I went to college. I wasn't sure what to do. I was ready to leave home, so to speak, the nest. And I took a course on philosophy, and it just intrigued me at the time. Just the ability of logical thought, the ability to have an ability to critique or not take everything at face value, not just jump on board, so to speak, with everyone. And it really intrigued me. And that's kind of how my interest in philosophy began. And it kind of pervaded through college. I had this science bent, so I did a little bit in science and in chemistry as well. And it's kind of, you know, pervaded kind of my thinking. And I think a little bit coming from the circumstances, I think that you and myself and others have come, the concepts of surviving, you know, my parents survived and my mother survived Auschwitz.
Yeah.
I spoke a little bit to her. And how is it that one survives? How's one have the will and the ability to do that? And in the book, I try to tell a few stories of people, how they developed a sense of a routine and were able to, even in the worst circumstances, stabilize their environment and find hope, meaning, and purpose in their life, even in the worst circumstances. So I think survival and philosophy, you know, balanced with science has been something I think that, you know, although it took quite a few years to come to understand how they all connect, became my interest.
Yeah, and it's very, very profound to think about how you are controlling your thoughts. And if you can control your thought, then your situation will change, right? Yep. If you are able to assess the fact that, hey, I can have a different perspective here. Yeah, it can be optimistic, or it can be a negative perspective, or I can, and that thought is going to actually create some feelings in me where I will not take action, or I'm not a survivor.
That's right.
Think about Frankl Victor that says suffering is inevitable, but it's your mind that would allow you to survive. And I think a lot of immigrants carry that formidable thinking, that survival mode, like I'm going to do all the anything and everything it takes to make it. And that kind of pushes the drive. Because I always wonder, you know, that's the beauty of philosophy. Yeah. It kind of raises one question after the other, you know, how immigrants are able to push forward and thrive the way that we do. And it's that survival mode, and it's that philosophy that we add, that we empathize with those that we leave behind, or how our parents were able to survive through lesser circumstances. So I'm glad you shared that. It's a profound thought, for sure.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I do think that organization and structure are maybe more important now than ever. And if you kind of, it's interesting because if you look at kind of what happened now with COVID, and obviously I'm fairly familiar with, you know, the SARS-2 virus and the COVID and what occurred here. And of course, experiencing that both in the medical, because I'm the medical director of the emergency medical services locally.
Yeah.
So I'm still fairly involved in healthcare. You start to kind of look at it. This was very unique. It was a very unique event, which put us into a very much survival mode, into a mode of uncertainty. It did something. It's very akin, because I was like watching a little bit about World War II and what was happening in London when the bombs were occurring and how people were sheltering. And it's a very similar kind of event of survival to try to overcome the uncertainty that was occurring. But it was very unique. And if you think about it, in the United States, short of, and not to make light of it, the Pearl Harbor bombing or in some degrees, the 9/11 occurrence. The United States has always fought their wars off of the shores, whether it's World War I, World War II, Vietnam, Iraq. And this is, short of those instances, it's kind of the first time, and especially the new generations, have actually come under, in a sense, attack by a sort of invisible force. And we did things that have never really been done before because of our ability to communicate like we do so quickly, so fast on our iPhones through different media and understand things. And we went into a very very unusual sheltering in place and being put into environments that we've never really been without socialization and the sort, and had to basically, our everyday life and routines were completely broken. And suddenly we had to develop some other ways of really coping. Suddenly we realize that our environment and where we shelter are important, our homes, because now we're forced to be in those homes.
It brings us back to the basic. It brings us back home. It brings us to our innate nature, who we are, community, bonding, and connectedness. It brings us right back. And I think it allows us, I think that's what happened in the last year also, is it just brings us back to be grounded. Because I think we were so caught up in being busy, being doing that we forgot the nature of who we really are. And it kind of helped us to silence ourselves for a bit, or quiet down the commotion or the movement that's been going on.
Noise. It's almost like a reset of the thermostat a little bit, where suddenly you might be home and you looked at that couch and you said, I've been running in and out. Now I've got to sit on that couch. I better buy a new couch. I want to make this to be nice if I'm going to be here. And so people's routines, their abilities to, in the case of families. So there was a lot of collateral damage. What I talk about, of course, the healthcare damage, the delay in healthcare.
Yeah.
Some things that were very difficult where families were apart, elderly, and your elder parents, you couldn't visit them to some degree. There was a lot of things that were very different and very difficult. And even in healthcare, mothers, for example, mothers and fathers who were parents, who were nurses early on, had this conflict because they had to go home and take care of their kids and shelter, but they were asked to come to the hospital to help. Mm-hmm. And they really had this conflict because there was no more daycare. There was nobody, we had to be home. And how do I go and help give care, but I have to care for my children? So it caused kind of a workforce issue even at the time. But what I like to talk about is to say that we kind of have these internal clocks and these rhythms in our body that are really why we always want our, I call it little time bubbles, time being the routine, the regularity of what we do, and the bubble being just as an analogy, they'd asked me to do that as kind of your environment. And we go through life, even when we're born in our little, in our wombs that are very stable and finally get born, that the, our bubbles burst and then we recreate new times, new stability. And this is internal to our bodies, which is the good meaning of some of this different, what I call collateral value that we've learned. But circadian rhythms is one thought of science that, you know, we learn. I mean, there's a reason our hearts beat regularly. They're not irregular. We perceive the world with a lot of rhythm, a lot of regularity, and actually a lot of routine. And consequently, it makes us feel stable and more certain when we know things are going to happen. In the book, I talk about not just our own personal or work routines, but I talk about how important rituals are, yeah. How things that we can depend on, whether they're religious or the holiday or the New Year resolution, how the seasons come and how knowing and expecting that gives us a certain sense of certainty. So this is why for group and social aspects, rituals are very important. They have a time sense to them. They can bring us together. And throughout history, humans have developed, you know, these type of rituals. And when you kind of talk about like your personal chronobiology, you start to learn that there are that all animals have a certain biology, and that circadian rhythms, which won the Nobel Prize for figuring out the actual molecular nature of why it is and what happens to our circadian rhythms. And people would ask me, and they'd say, well, at 3 o'clock, I had a company ask me, I can't get anybody alert or awake to do most anything. I said, well, you know, that's why the English have tea. And that's why Spanish cultures would often have siestas and sleep. Mm-hmm. And sometimes French and Italian cultures, I'm talking more about European culture right now, would have sex. And well, the hypothalamus kind of controls the eating, the food, and some of the sexual drives of your brain. We know that fairly well. And what happens to cortisol, adrenocorticotropic hormone, and what happens to glucose around 3 o'clock approximately. Some people are larks and some people are owls. You know, they stay up later and the sort. But there is this very important rhythm that if you understand that rhythm, then you can and try to kind of adjust to it, like you were saying earlier, then your ability to be productive and also feel better and more content becomes very important. So I remember that when I was running our company, every 2 weeks, we try to have some. I realized that having meetings that were spreadsheet meetings going over financials, very, very specific, diligent meetings that had a lot of detail, didn't really work at 3 o'clock. Now, in the morning, when one awakens, is a great time not only just to exercise, but also to do a lot of diligent work. That also happens after dinner a bit later, about 7 to 9 o'clock. And so that what I was trying to do is also in a social group sync within even a business culture, but this is also personal. Know when was the best times for me to do the kind of work I need to do, especially now that people have been at home and doing more virtual work. So morning exercise and through approximately 10 o'clock doing very diligent, very detailed work. By the time it becomes 10 o'clock to lunch and after 2 is a really great time for people engagement. This is when people are best for engaging. These are great times for the virtual call, so to speak, or for people who are recruiting to recruit and engage with people or whatever it might be that you're doing in a collaborative fashion. By the time it gets to be 2 or 3 o'clock, our glucose is dropping, our cortisols are dropping. You know, Americans are going to Starbucks for coffee or getting some form of coffee. They're trying to get energy. And so what I used to do when I had at least group meetings is I'd make those an innovation meeting. I'd make sure I fed people. We sat around and we did big thinking, macro thinking, innovative thinking. And I think the staff like that. Some companies, if even realizing chronobiology, have said, okay, it's 3 o'clock, everybody go home. Okay, just everybody, it's over, go home, get energy, go deal with your family, get some exercise, have dinner. But at 7 to 9 o'clock, I want you to start working again.
Yeah. I mean, it's going against that whole notion, those 9 to 5, right? Exactly. Like putting 8-9 hours of straight up productivity. That's unrealistic. Like you said, we have different chronotypes. So, you know, we have different chronobiologies where some people are more productive in the morning and vice versa. But because of this structured 9 to 5, you have to be there. You have to be productive and produce at this time. Sometimes it's counterintuitive. Right. Because then people are wasting. I heard a shocking news study that, you know, people take, it's like 4 hours. They will actually just work 4 hours in an 8 hour day.
Right.
Real deep work. The rest of it is just la-di-da. And just,
right. Where they can be productive. Know. Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, in corporations, I ran a fairly large segment of a healthcare company, almost a $1 billion company. You know, people were trying to figure out how do you make staff productive? You know, suddenly they have overlays and you start noticing people are on the web surfing, you know, they're not unable to focus, or they're trying to socialize internally in the sort. All of these are human things that in good environments, creating a stable environment in business that understands the chronobiology and gets the right routines, and then even develops great rituals. This is what good leaders need to be able to understand in operating their companies, in my opinion.
Yeah. What are some of the good habits that can be implemented in the workplace?
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. And, you know, technically, habits are almost automated behaviors. Often it comes from the psychological realm of research and, you know, rewards and the sort. But those things that become kind of automated, because you can have good or bad habits, right? You can have the things that you do. And that's what I've been trying to kind of separate a little bit when I talk to companies that are in distress or families that are in distress or individuals, is that it's not about the content. It isn't. It, content's important. What you do is important. But what's important is that you do what you do in an organized and structured way, and that it coordinates with how our biology is, our physiology, our endocrinology. The body tries to reach homeostasis and equilibrium. You look at either a molecular level or a physiology level, that's what the body's doing. And it's very, very important to focus that maybe having more routine and regularity may be more important than what it is you do. So people say, well, routines are boring to me. And I said, well, you can change what you do. Often they ask me, if you're not happy with what you do, or you don't like the content of what you do, if you're doing yoga or Pilates and don't like doing, let's say, just talk exercise, for example, it's okay. Just change it. Change the content. Mm-hmm. Go do Tai Chi, or go walk, or go bicycle. You can even change the time. Right. When you start to do it regularly. Do it in a routine. Do it organized. Your body will appreciate that. Do it in an environment that's that way.
That is sound advice, because habits are being created without our permission anyways. Right. We have a routine. So the people that says they hate routine and don't like habits, they already have one. That's what the brain does. The brain create habits to solve our problems. See, the brain wants to automate everything for us. So it's just a matter of becoming conscious and cognizant of the habits that we are creating. So tell us about the science. What does science say about routine and habits?
Well, you know, it's interesting because although there's quite a bit of psychological science, there isn't a lot of, this is why I became interested, because there isn't a lot of study of the actual behavior of regularity in the sort. There's a lot about a reward and punishment type of things that reward you. And we understand now, for example, we understand better now that where we've talked about the left side of the brain and the right side of the brain, the master and their emissary, like a famous book about how the brains work and how they have more cognitive pieces. We're also understanding that the midbrain, the middle part of the brain, is where we learn a lot of very interesting and early behaviors. And one of my, it was a college classmate, but now at UCSB is the professor, Greg Ashby here. He has the keys to the MRI, and they've been doing some really interesting studies about how the midbrain brings early things on that then become really centered and set in the mind that get learned and get locked, can kind of get locked in
subconsciously.
Right. And how there really is this kind of, when you do certain things and you do them regularly and you complete that task, let's say making your bed or whatever it is, because people often ask me, what is it? How do I get into a routine? The brain secretes an amount of dopamine, dopamine is one of the things that gives you those good feelings, you know? And you've heard about people having endorphins, right, when they run, or getting into a bit of a zone, kind of an automated zone when they're running or exercising or whatever it might be, that your mind kind of relaxes. Well, a lot of these are functions that are coming from the midbrain and are used. We've used them in kind of understanding certain diseases like Parkinson's disease. It's interesting. They have there's one classic video of someone who has Parkinson's, you know, where they're very stiff, can't move. They could also have a the tremor, the 5 per second tremor that you have. And you would think those people who can barely move couldn't ride a bicycle, but they get on a bicycle and they begin to ride the bicycle. And the motion of the stiffness, the contractions and the tremors go away. So we're learning that there's some deep aspects that are in the brain related to dopamine in the sword that make a big difference in how you can respond. So one of the things in Yale, they teach a course on happiness and on the science of well-being, which is an interesting course. And just more, you know, behaviorally, those same things are happening when you do things that make you content. Okay. And so people often ask me, okay, so I don't like what I'm doing. You're telling me that I need to do it regularly, but sometimes what is it that I choose? What should I choose to do? And I said, obviously that is what you do. That's why it's the art of routine, is because you get to choose the content. It's the art, it's your creation, it's your individualism. But again, learn to do that regularly, and it can change, and it will by life naturally changes what you do in your routines. And it was interesting because in that course, it's the most popular course in Yale, by the way. Of course, it's well over 2 or 3 million people. And one of the things they talk about in getting the brain synced, like you talked about, if you're trying to change what you do, and is to try to find those things that give you a certain sense of happiness and contentment. You have to experiment a little bit with that. But when you do find that, whether it's like in a sensual way, a long shower or a good glass of wine or food or whatever it might be, what you want to do is savor that. Take a little more time and let your brain begin to work its balance into, so to speak, the midbrain and the sword, and get a certain amount of training, so to speak, into enjoying that. Because sometimes, and this is talked about, that there are things like one buys a new car or has some new environment or a home, and these things give you a lot of contentment and happiness. But pretty soon we adapt to those. We're very adaptable animals. That's why we can survive and survive so well. But those things sometimes are fleeting. And so a little bit more of experiential things that make you content and happy will have a longer lasting, so to speak, tracks in your brain and the sort, with both the complexities of dopamine and those things that make you anxious, the adrenocorticotropic hormone and the sort, the things that make for the stress response in the body. So I think that's pretty, I like that advice, because often people say, well, you're not telling me what to do. What should I do? You know, and I say, well, I can give you some ideas. I can be prescriptive for people that have had really difficulties, not just through COVID, but they've disrupted their routines and their lives. You know, I sometimes kidding around, because we're enthusiasts, we say, get a dog. Okay, you get a dog, you're going to have a routine started for you, because there's a time they have to walk, a time you have to feed, a time they have to poop, you know, so to speak. And there are aids in getting into a routine and getting a certain sense of joy and contentment. And I think animals, because of their human nature and our connectivity to them, bring us some of that contentment or joy. And so other people, I say, look, take that shower that you like and do it just a little bit longer to savor it, and begin doing it regularly. Don't skip. Mm-hmm. And so these things that you hear about, like making your bed early in the morning, or one of the things that I like, because it connects pretty well with the brain, is I like affirmations. Mm-hmm. It's now in the digital world, it's easy to do morning affirmations, because you can put it on your phone and it'll alert you. It's 6 in the morning or 7 in the morning, or wherever you're waking up, and it says daily affirmation. And it's a way of kind of getting the day started, to maybe gather the day in your brain, maybe say something positive. If you like something positive, I've got a big day today. I'm going to have a great presentation, and I'm so looking forward to seeing my friends at dinner tonight. Where it can be like Stuart Smalley used to have these affirmations. That was an old movie there, you know, that would wake up every morning and say, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like me. You know, that's an old famous affirmation. It's interesting, because also affirmations, I like them because they're simple and can kind of set your day. And affirmations also, there've been purposes. You remember night prayer, praying at night before the next day, so that you feel good about going, essentially resting and going to sleep and what will happen. Night prayer. So night affirmations are similar to that. We've kind of almost as humans developed some of these rituals, again, to find stability, define regularity, routine, to give us a sense of certainty and stability, the things that our physiology, the equilibrium, the homeostasis our body likes. So that's a little bit of the nature's insight. I think people have wanted me to be a little more prescriptive. Hey, you're a doctor. What should, give me a prescription. People often want the 1, 2, 3, the simplicity. And it's, one can develop some easy, you know, thoughts or ideas in that. But like with patients, the reason medicine is a bit of an art is because although we all are similar, we're all a bit different too. And so there's a uniqueness. And I think that's the art, and the art of routine, mm-hmm. and the art of medicine also.
Yeah, I know affirmations dive right into the subconscious mind, especially if you do it in first thing in the morning when you're at alpha state, yes. right? Where the brain is just barely waking up. You're between a trance, sleeping and waking up, and the subconscious mind is susceptible to receiving information and soaking it up. And now the positive affirmation is great because the subconscious mind will receive it. Same thing with right before falling asleep. It's you get at that state where you kind of, I think there's a quote that says, do not go to sleep without giving your subconscious mind something to work on.
Right.
And so that affirmation does exactly that. Or looking at your goals, your plans for tomorrow, kind of get the subconscious mind revving up and working on your behalf while you're resting.
Yes.
But talking about the subconscious mind, talk to us about the limbic system, right? Because that's automated. Yeah. It's like the battle between the limbic system versus the frontal cortex. That's where procrastination lives.
And some of the research, you know, which was, you know, done, I think that research was done a little bit earlier, but that balance of kind of the, I'll call it the introvert and the extroverts in us, and the balance of being able to function from both regularity and the thought, the overthought that occurs with, you know, your frontal brain and the sort. And then basically the limbic system, that's all, like I'm talking about midbrain, that's some of the new research that's coming out and showing the importance of it. So understanding the science, and granted, is it practical to understand the science? Is the research, you know, practical enough? You know, some of psychological, and the same with science, you know, you have to have being in philosophy and being somewhat philosophical, you have to be able to critique studies. So you have to be very careful of what comes out, you know, it's just some thoughts for your listeners to not take any study that comes about that says, do this or do that, or here's what we found. Just take it with a little grain of salt, because in today's university worlds and the sort, and although we've made lots of strides, there's a lot of, you know, publish or perish. There's get the grants, you know, today. And so a lot of the studies that come out are not always good science. They don't have great research design. They don't have study design. And I don't want to get into the whole concept of study design, but, you know, we talk about double blind control placebo studies, right? You know, being excellence in clinical medicine. And so I ask people to think about it. You know, you'll see a study and it's got 20 people in it over 2 years. And you go, well, that can't have a very good conclusion. 20 people that were studied.
Be careful what you read. Don't believe everything you read or hear.
Right. And so having a certain sense of having a critical nature for it. If you look at what we do behaviorally, which is kind of how this came about for me, why are people that have lived long lives, why are they so steady in their routines? Why do they have a stable environment? Why are there some very interesting blue zones, you know, in Sardinia, Italy, even in California, Loma Linda, where the Adventist, what is it that makes for these environments that allow people to thrive in them, maybe a little more so than areas where, well, they've got their time bubbles, their social are very distinct in the sort. But I think to your point, the science that's been known about how our brains have their own constituting contrasts, and how there's a bit of a challenge of how the science of our brains work. So it helps us at least explain a little bit of why we are where we are, and surely understand kind of like what we did. So in psychiatry, and it's interesting because a lot of people think that the medications that we used, you know, psychotropic medications, anti-anxiety medications, antidepressant medications, to me, they were one of the greatest inventions. Okay, but what is it that we do when someone is incredibly disturbed with mental disease or some behavior, some issue? What we try to do is to stabilize their environment, right? We first try to utilize some brain chemistry on how to coordinate how to make serotonin work in the place with some of these meds. But then we put them in environments that are social. We give them a routine, a structure, an organization. You know, whether it's the hospital or even not behavior, that's what we do in medicine when our bodies are in stress. We try to find stability, rhythm, regularity, and organization. And so these are just some insights that I think are part of our human nature and how we explain them through theories of more psychotherapeutic theories like the subconscious mind, right, in that way, or more anatomical approaches like a limbic system, you know, versus the different aspects of the cortex and the temporal lobes and all the parts that we know that they do. And it's very, what we do know about ourselves, and we have some science that can guide treatment or guide self-awareness so that we can hopefully do that. What we do know is if you even look at other species, that regularity, rhythm, momentum, arguably, you know, of course, routine, a stable environment, which trying to survive is constantly in flux. You know, look at the refugees today of Syria or Rohingya. People are trying to find that stability, food, water, shelter, a place for their lives, an ability to for their children to put forth the species, you know, so to speak, and the sort. And you see this in animal life too. So I think that my insight is one insight. There's different ways to look at it, but I think it's an important one, particularly when either individual, and I started writing this before COVID. COVID just helped accelerate, so to speak, like it did many things, the concept of how important our environments are and how important doing things in some organized and routine and structured way.
Yeah, I agree. Environment plays a big role, a big key. So, and that's why in morning routine is like an environmental structure to actually set you up and prime you for the day, prime me for the day. So I want to get into your morning routine. How do you get up, dress up, and show up?
Well, you know, thank you for that piece. I wanted to just make one other point that it is harder to change environments when you're older or very young. Okay. And we've seen this, that people that are older, when they change their environment, come into the hospital, they're not familiar with the surroundings. We call it a sundowning syndrome. Quite a few things interesting happen to the brain. Children as well. It seems in the middle years, we're able to be more out of habit, out of routine, able to experience more and to take that stress that occurs. I just wanted to make that point. And so, you know, for me, it's a little bit of what we talked about. You know, I feel better and like I have a bit more control when I make my bed in the morning. You know, now I have to deal with that with my wife, depending on the timing and all about when you make that bed. I'm also someone that I like that the affirmation piece. That's a more a personal piece. I found it to be simple. Meditation, for example, is a little more complex. You know, getting beta waves in your brain and the relaxation and what it does. Remember, breathing is rhythmic. You know, this is, again, I'm going back to how our bodies are structured and why we want to behave like our bodies do. And so, you know, an affirmation is a really, for me, been a very good, like you said, when awakening, a nice way to set even as you're changing to a more conscious approach in life. So those are two things that I like to do. I've looked at some interesting data about what's the average when people wake up. And in the United States, it was like 6:56 in the morning. You know, everybody's got kind of their different routines. So those are the things. And for me, I grew up in Argentina, a little bit more of a European culture that doesn't have like a big breakfast, you know, so I'm a fairly light breakfast eater. But I try to routinely not be bored, but have the same thing to get started. You know, it's the same coffee. The same for me, more of a breakfast bar type of thing. And that stability in the morning sets, I think, the rest of the day that's been planned. And again, I usually try to then do writing. I can write in the morning when I do writing. I can do financial spreadsheets in the sort. I can do those things that are within myself, not so much an engagement. And then I try to schedule meetings and engagements after 10 o'clock for myself and start the process of the day. I also try to keep a fairly steady intermediate morning exercise of some sort, at least three of the days a week. Some people tell me, well, you know, I have that, but I let my Sunday be free for me, you know? Am I breaking the routine because my Saturday or my Sundays, you know, in work life, the way we work is, you know, Sunday, we're learning different ways to work, but Sunday to Friday, and then we have the routine. And I said, no, that's okay. You can have a freedom of changing what you do, But the fact is that it's good that it's still a routine. It is still Sundays. It is every Sunday, you know, so it's a more macro regularity of what you do, no different than the seasons are more of a macro routine of what happens in the world we perceive. So that's a little bit about, you know, for myself. I don't think utterly unique, but it's my way of feeling good and syncing up in the morning.
And that's the beauty. That's the beauty of having your own routine, because you're different from me. I'm different from you and vice versa. And that's what you encourage your client is to find what works for you, right?
Right. What that kind, and then when they ask me what it is, I try to say, try to find something that you do that makes you content, makes you happy, and then stick to it. Stick to it.
Experience with it. Yeah. Experience with it. I actually give my clients what I call a chronotype quiz to find out when is the best time for them to get up in the morning, when is the best time for them to go to sleep, because the morning routine does start the night before. And then we go out to plan the day for productivity.
Yes.
You know, if people can get up at five. Four different chronotypes, right? You can get up at 5:30, you can get up at 6:30, 7:30, and 7 o'clock. But it's when you do get up, what do? Because what we do in the first 10 minutes, as you doctors like yourself say, and myself say, it influences the rest of the day. The first 10 minutes. Like if
it really doesn't. You know, it's very interesting because, of course, there's normal behavior. There's hypo behavior, like, you know, you're not manic, but hypomanic. Or so you see the middle, and then you see the outliers, right? There are people that one has to help adjust because they just can't get to sleep. You know, sleep is a very big issue. I'm learning that right now, that how many friends and family and others that call me and say, hey, I don't know what happened. I used to sleep well, and now I don't. You know, so there are some changes that happen with aging and different times in your life. And then there is, you know, outliers, people that actually have, you know, problems sleeping because they have things like sleep apnea.
Yeah.
As you get older, you know, parts of your throat and the sort loosen up. And, you know, this is when, you know, snoring begins, right? And breathing.
Yeah.
So there are outlier disease that you sometimes has to be customized for them.
Yeah. I know a group of people that are considered to be wolves that are more productive. One, they don't go to sleep until midnight.
Right.
And they are more productive from 5 p.m. to 11.
Exactly.
Like that's outliers to the max, right? Like they're against the 9 to 5. They start revving up. They start getting their productivity after everyone has dinner. And that's when they can work on their big things, like writing the book, being creative. And, you know, that's not the norm, but people need to understand that's okay.
Yeah, Like I talk about it, like some people are night owls and some people are larks. Some people have to get up earlier and some can even stretch that, like you just said, can be arguably abnormal in the sense, and that it can be okay though, even though you're not in the piece. And it's interesting because with COVID or war or survival, and when there's less, you know, food, less shelter, less of everything sometimes, and not say that's the case, but there was less toilet paper, right? There were different things that humans kind of interestingly went towards. There starts to be more of a movement across the line. You start to spread the normality to be able to get what you need to do, whether it's sleep, food, shelter, water. And it's an interesting study. They did an interesting study called the behavioral sync, where they put the synchronization of behavior with, in this case, mice, of course, trying to apply them to humans, where they had a closed environment, right? They had only so much room. They started with a small group and the population grew. And even though they had food all the time, they all went to the food at the same time. Eventually, there were so many that were fighting for the food, even though they could begin to spread out, you know, later on to eat, earlier to eat, so that it wasn't the same battle. Anyway, that's a famous, I think, experiment and was related to overpopulation. But my point is that some of these changes that we're seeing now are somewhat related to, again, my analogy that it's different than World War II or the wars we've been in. But for the first time, we've been, you know, having to isolate, and we're going to now have to have a good, you know, we've learned a lot of collateral value from this. We've learned some very interesting things. We've learned about, I try to sometimes quantify some of them, so I maybe can tell you, but we've learned a little bit about routines and regularity and rhythm and momentum, which were disrupted. We've learned a little bit about our environment, our home, our workplace, how important the environments that we're in actually are. We learned the value of family, of being there, surviving together, you know, some people had a hard time. They didn't have a family. They were left alone. So you kind of, by the negative consequences, learn the value of that, those things that we do value.
Yeah.
We learn a little bit about introspection, about life, who we are, about asking philosophical questions. I think for people, not everyone is able to do that, but we've also learned the limitations of technology and how to communicate and the importance of in-person interactions. You know, this, the Zoom, the virtual, we're learning that's not just the end. We're missing seeing people below their noses and see what they look like. I know we had experiences where people say, "Hi, Dr. Iskovich, how you doing?" And I'd look and I wouldn't know who it was, even though somehow they knew who I was. We're learning right now, everybody is seen a little bit as a viral threat. And how you get to shake someone's hand or hug someone again, you know, is going to be actually interesting because we've had conditioning, right? And kind of the same things that happen with habits, you know, a conditioning that people, in order to survive, we need to stay away.
So habits are going to be very important in re-entering.
Yes.
You know, readapting back to what our normal was. Yes. It's going to require some really hacking of the brain to get that moving really fast.
Yes. And this will be interesting for your clients to see how you're able to use and understand the brain to now get into back to a transition. People have asked me, like, how do I get back? I can't go to work. I can't. I'm having a hard time shaking hands. I'm afraid. You know, and I had written a little piece just now. They said, "Well, God, I just don't know. I think it's a little bit like a cold shower. There's a couple ways to get into a cold shower. You know, you either go right into it or ease your way into it and condition yourself to seeing that it's okay." Yeah. So there's a lot of questions to answer. And one of my greatest concerns has also been the value, you know, for a year and a half or so, we've had a lot of children in different parts of the country be at home, be away from each other at a time that, you know, socialization is real important. You know, those years, your first grade and preschool where you're learning how to behave, you know, because sometimes I wonder how we behave. How can we stop at red lights and how can we get in line, you know, when we're getting our food or our coffee? For the most part, I think that's what's learned at that period of time in the early school years and early socialization is how to hold hands, how to get behind, how to behave. And I do have a bit of a concern that there's been a year to a year and a half missed of that socialization. So I think that's something that many people, I know a friend that said, you know, I just can't have in this time in my child's life, not be only be at home and not be with other peers. And they moved to a state that had more open, you know, with restrictions, open education in that regard. So that's another thing, you know, there've been a lot of interesting lessons that have come from this.
Yeah, I didn't think about the kids being away from school and how the little things that we learn at that age, how it carries over with us into adulthood. You know, the thing you said about stopping and being able to go at stoplights, we're being trained, we're being constructed at a very young age. So that's part
of it. Yes, right, exactly. And I think it leads to why it is that socially our brains work in that way and why we keep a little bit of peace in order. I mean, you see that with other pandemics, you see, you know, civil disobedience. You know, we, of course, have had that type of thing into, you know, some very interesting accelerated cultural movements. So anyway, I find that interesting. And I try to give some stories in the book about high performers. I talk about the Rolling Stones who you think wouldn't be routine. And I try to talk about my friend who survived 8 years in the Hanoi prison in Vietnam. How did he do it? And the kids that survived that in Thailand that were caught in a cave that was filled with water, you know, that they couldn't get out. So there's some, and a little bit about direct relief in Haiti and what happened there. And so I think people, you know, as opposed to just the science and the sort, like to hear what those examples are in different circumstances. So anyway, that's a little bit of what I've been working on.
That's great. So Dr. I, tell us where we can connect with you. How can we find a book?
The book comes out on June 1st. It's been delayed because of COVID, like many other things have. And it's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. The publishers are Skyhorse. It's on Simon & Schuster, who's distributing it. And I've got all the handles on, you know, Dr. I or angeliskovich.com, you know, so I've got that also. If you can get my name out or look at Dr. I, and I was hoping that it would have some value being kind of a caregiver, that it might give a little bit of insight into who we are, how we are, and how we can improve and understand that there's hope, meaning, and purpose just in having routine and good habits and the sort. So,
very nice. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. This has been insightful to learn the science behind our habits and our routines, and to just see the evolution over time, the brain, how it evolves and how it affects our behaviors, the human behavior. Yes. And the adjustment that's going to have to take place. I really appreciate your insight on the science behind it all. That has been very helpful. Thank you again for coming in today.
My pleasure. And there's a lot of science that's out there behind it. I'm trying to organize it now in a way that's focused on routine. So, yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. So we'll put all that on the show notes. Thank you again for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, morning enthusiasts, that's it for today's show. Thank you for tuning in. If you love the Best Morning Routine Ever podcast, we'd love to hear from you. So go ahead and subscribe, rate, and give a review on iTunes or Google Play. While you're at it, tell a friend about the show. Be sure to visit bestmorningroutineever.com and our Facebook group to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover our fantastic free bonus content. Until next time.